Well, hello everyone, and welcome to another one of these talks I'm doing with Todd Lewis. He's been a popular guest in the past couple of weeks, and he's back today to talk about the corporate oligarchy that controls America. But as ever with Todd, he's not just going to start now, he's going to look back a little bit in history. Before we get going, though, Todd, anything you'd like to promote, sir?
Definitely check out my channel at the Praise with Folly podcast. We have shows on Tuesdays and Thursdays. And you can follow me on X at PLF podcast.
Fantastic. And I will just play my ad. Christmas is coming up, so I encourage people to buy the Trivium. And when we come back, we're going to talk about the aforementioned corporate oligarchy.
Academic Agency.
All right. So when you wanted to talk about this, you know, originally I thought, well, this, I mean, to me, corporations and corporate control was something that was a fairly mainstream topic in the late 90s, early 2000s. Do you remember the documentary, The Corporation?
Oh, yes. That was a good one. Yeah.
Yeah. Mid-noughties. And there was a lot of stuff around, how corporations actually count as a person and have the same rights as a person. And there was, Naomi Klein, no logo. This sort of stuff was kind of vogue for a while. And then basically everybody stopped talking about it and kind of were meant to forget about it. But that is not you're not simply coming here to rehash early 2000 documentary talking points, are you, Todd?
No.
Why didn't you outline what you want to talk about here?
Yeah, so I'll begin with this. On the right and the left in the United States, there has been, almost working from two separate sides towards the middle, there's been efforts at unveiling this. Now, the left side is more famous, more well-known, and you mentioned it with the corporation and the anti-globalist left, you know, the 1999. But amongst what we might call the old right or certain business conservatives and even some libertarians, there is this sense that there are these this criticism of a higher system. Now, one level of that criticism would be theoretical, like Murray Rothbard, where he says that, you know, he uses Gabriel Coco, the sort of Marxist historian, to say, look, these corporations get government favors and patronage. They can do things that we can't. So therefore, you know, we need to... In fact, during the noughties, the whole corporate personhood thing was a talking point amongst libertarians as well. But what
sorry to interrupt. It's probably worth pointing out that, you know, because some people watching this will be coming from a Marxist lens. They won't really understand that. Libertarians see the corporation as a function of the state, as the outcome of the interaction between the firm, right, which is a company, and state level cronyism, and various different laws that happen. So, in Murray Rothbard's analysis, the corporation is kind of a state backed monopoly, even if it's not a monopoly, it has certain privileges, certain kind of exceptions within the law made for it by virtue of its relationship with power. I should just mention that the best book on this exact topic is still, in my mind, Todd, Nemesis by C.A. Bond, on exactly what the corporation is as a legal function. And I would describe that as a work of elite theory, really. So that is just a couple of little notes there. Tell me if you disagree with anything I said.
No, I don't disagree with all. The only thing I'd add is that they would argue that, again, from the theory level, a libertarian might argue that the monopolies are the government granted privileges that certain firms have. Now, there's two levels of this kind of critique. There's the theory critique, and then there's the sort of like, what do these things do? What do these corporations do? How do they, you know, distort, in the libertarian case, I guess, the market, but the republic and bribe politicians, and how do they get us involved in wars and all of that? Now, there is this old right tradition, which, again, we see a little bit out with Sutton, which we saw last time we were on together. The idea that these corporations are at play in order to, on the one hand, you know, you have the typical libertarian talking point, undermine free trade and competition, but also a position more that the left would hear, you know, that the republic is being subverted by corporate interests. You don't hear conservatives or Republicans say that today, but there was a time when certain elements of the old right, and it does exist in certain forms with like the John Birch Society, which of course are in the outs right now politically, but they would also see this as an attempt. And so what I would like to talk about today is how they sort of took power and maintained power and in the early days when they were taking over, because that's the thing that I've noticed when I read that the left literature, they don't really talk about how the oligarchy starts in the United States. And the other thing is they have this reticence to name names, which is odd, right? Rockefeller, Carnegie, Ford, and their corporations, they would be like, well, we want to talk about forces, not names of individuals. Well, yeah, but like if these corporate forces have CEOs that determine their policy and do things, then it is important to follow that. So that's sort of
I should mention, Todd, we've possibly just seen an example, a naked example of it, where I don't know if you saw this, but Netflix tried to buy Warner Brothers. Okay, did you see this?
No, I did not.
Like literally the past couple of days, Netflix tried to buy Warner Brothers. In the bidding war to buy Warner Brothers, Paramount was part of the process. Paramount is run affiliated, let's just say, with one of Donald Trump's best buddies at the moment, Larry Ellison, the guy who bought CBS and the guy who bought TikTok. Well, Trump, it turns out, has a problem with this deal and may move to block the purchase. So keep your eyes on that one, because I mean, Trump is doing some of the most naked kind of crony corrupt stuff I've ever seen a president do at the moment. And it's just so in your face. But anyway, carry on, Todd. I don't want to get us bogged down in Trump. Yeah.
So I think where and both elements, I think, are looking at the same thing, right? This corporate beast that's taking over, but they're coming at it from different perspectives. And I believe that there are blind spots that each can cover, right? So I'm going to try to, this is to be a bit of a summary of my attempt at synthesizing the two. The first thing that needs to be known is it's very hard to follow this history because, well, a lot of the private papers of these corporate firms are not allowed for anyone to just read. And you're going to have to, you know, look at other events that are happening and then read between the lines and infer. But I think that the place to start is what we call in the American historical moment, the great rapprochement between Great Britain and the United States. So from 1895 to 1915, there was a massive pivot in American policy from being anti-British to being pro-British. During the 20th century, British politicians admitted that their policies in Europe would have been impossible without American support. It's very poorly studied and known. So there isn't, it's really hard to study the Great Rapprochement because it's one of the things that you don't really talk about. But the important thing to take away here is that America becomes very pro-British and aligned with British imperial and financial interests, because the financial elements of the United States are realigning towards Great Britain. And this is the culmination of, you mentioned the corporation earlier, the documentary, these large firms conglomerating around corporate personhood status. And now what they're doing is they're pivoting American foreign policy towards Great Britain, the historic enemy of the United States. And the other thing that happens within this time period is the formation.
Sorry, I don't want to keep on interrupting you, but as you were talking, the book that I have read that really looks into this, you may have not come across it, is this book here. It's called America Conquers Britain by L. Denny.
No, this I've was not.
This was written in 1930. It's written by an American, I believe, who is more or less boasting about this process, because when you say it pivoted towards being pro-British, it did actually like take over a lot of the British economy as well. And, you know, by 1930, you've already got books with titles like this. One of the great discoveries I made watching a documentary called An Ocean Apart by Adam Curtis. And a lot of this book in particular, I've never seen anywhere else talk about some of the stuff that went on. But anyway, go on, Todd. Go on.
Yeah, no, that's very interesting. Now, by a line, I mean primarily on foreign policy issues. So basically, the American state becomes a sort of bailout for the British Empire when they start a war they can't win. That's the main takeaway here. Now, two other things happen that are very important. There's the formation of the Federal Reserve Bank in 1913. Now, that's a very right-wing talking point within this context. But why is this important? Well, the wars that both the anti-globalist left and many on the old right criticized that the United States engages in would be impossible without the financing that the Federal Reserve Bank allows the government to do fight these wars. And so if you want to like map this as how do these wars occur? Why do they keep occurring? Well, part of it is financing, and you need a bank to do that. And then also the revolution in education. So in 1913, the Rockefellers had the General Education Board, where they discuss how to educate poor blacks and whites in the American South to get them integrated into the industrial economy. And they say the quiet part out loud. They say that their goal for education is to make everybody malleable to their will, that they don't want to have philosophers and statesmen and intellectuals. They want to have pliable, basically workers. And so in that this period, we see all of these elements coming out, coming together. They're not in control yet, but this is like step one. And so from 1895 to 1915, they are laying the foundations for their control over finance, over education, and over the government.
Okay. So, Todd, you still there?
Yeah, I'm here.
Yeah, so, okay, so this is all happening prior to the establishment of the Fed in 1913.
It begins before and then includes it, so that 20-year period, yeah.
Okay. And in this idea, the reason for doing it is ultimately war. It's ultimately the ability to wage war around the world.
That's part of it. Now, to get to the real meat of this, we have to jump ahead. In 1952 to 1954, there was a congressional investigation of nonprofits called the Reese Committee. And one of the lead investigators, Norman Dodd, was later interviewed in the 80s about this by two, Stan Monteith was one interviewer, and then I forget his name, but the author of The Creature from Jekyll Island also interviewed Norman Dodd. And he said that according to his research during the Reese Committee, which was to investigate nonprofits, which they believed were being used as fronts for corporate influence in the country. And so the conclusions that were reached by this investigation, which was prematurely terminated in 1954, was that they were trying to socially engineer America into an image that they thought would be most amenable to them. And that war was one of the most efficient ways to do it. There was a question asked by, I think it was in the board of the Carnegie Foundation, is there any means more effective than war to change the nature of a country? And they concluded that there wasn't. This is according to Norman Dodd. And according to Norman Dodd, then what they did was they then helped promote the Great War in Europe, World War I, in order to begin this process of, to quote Obama, I guess, radically altering America. This process, sort of as an intentional process, begins in the early 20th century.
But it didn't just radically alter America. It changed Europe forever, basically destroyed the remnants of the old order, the ancien regime, if you want to put it that way. Not just in, obviously, the one in France had already gone, but, you know, World War One, the net result of it is that all of these old imperial powers are swept off the board. Ottoman Empire gone, Russian Empire now kind of under a new form. You know, the Tsar is gone. Austro-Hungary Empire off the map. So, I mean, it really does change the world forever, World War One.
It really does. And this element, so there's obviously knock-on effects, right? The war itself, American entry into the war, has this effect of toppling these regimes. And in some cases, that was intentional. Like in Russia, you have prominent financiers of certain Middle Eastern extraction that supported both the February and October revolutions. So there's a whole galaxy of connection there. The other thing that's interesting is with regards to finance, the Western Entente powers during the early phases of the war from 1914 to 16 would really have not been able to wage war without importation of American armaments. In 1915, Great Britain had a shell shortage. That was the lack was supplied by the U.S. And William Jennings Bryan, who was in the Wilson administration, said, this is not neutral activity. We can't claim to be a neutral state and then supply weapons to one side. And so what we see like today with U.S. supplying weapons to Ukraine while not being at war with Russia, this whole trend is started in World War I, where the U.S. is an armaments manufacturers are supporting the Entente powers, as well as banks giving them favorable war loans.
Hmm. Yeah, I mean, from a certain point of view, and I know this point of view is prevalent among some people in America, especially when you look at the two world wars, it looks like, how can I put it, there was a kind of continuity between Britain and America, that they were like always ended up on the same side, doing each other's bidding, you know, America helping out Britain. And I, in fact, in that documentary, An Ocean Apart, that I mentioned, I did a whole series on it. I watched every single episode of it live, you know. And they were doing interviews with the soldiers. And the whole point of it was that a certain aspect of that kind of cultural, ethnic connection, you know, well, we're ultimately all Englishmen in the end, existed. But also, as per the title of the documentary, they were also an ocean apart. And a lot of the normal people, i.e. not the elites, not the governments, but just the normal, including some of the soldiers, were like, oh, what the hell are we doing here? This is a foreign country at the end of the day. We, you know, we're different people. We're, at this point, an American is not a Brit and a Brit is not an American. And, you know, certainly in World War II, some of the American soldiers were resented, you know, for coming over and taking people's wives and things like that. Some of the American soldiers themselves resented the fact that they seemed to be dying for somebody else's war. So, I mean, how is any of this sold, Todd, at the time? I mean, it wasn't popular, right, with normal people.
Well, exactly. The United States, up until World War I, it had a long isolationist tradition. You know, a lot of the idea was we come to the new world to avoid Europe's wars, Europe's, you know, which were not only just the actual wars and destruction of property, but the authoritarian governments that waged them, conscription and all that. This is where propaganda comes in. And I know you've mentioned Edward Bernays before, but a lot of his work is inspired by what the British and then later the Americans did in World War I in order to propagandize the American people to be ready for such a conflict. And Britain did many things. They cut the transatlantic cables so Germany couldn't send messages to North America. They, of course, fabricated completely absurd lies, such as Germany was massacring nuns and children in Belgium in order to gin up this kind of war fever. And so a lot of it ends up becoming the propaganda, again, what we are dealing with today, the idea that wealthy, powerful people are constructing narratives that help them get us into war. If you look at the lead up to World War I and the lead up to the 2003 war with Iraq, you can see lots of similarities in how you see this corporate political propaganda nexus forming.
Mm-hmm. Just to push back a little bit, though, on the one hand, I can kind of see what you're saying, but on the other, it does seem quite an extraordinary claim, Todd, that the bloodiest war of all time in history to that point, I think World War II was equally as bloody, or if not more people died in World War II, but I mean, World War I was, I mean, one of the most brutal wars ever in history, millions of people dead. Are you saying that this was engineered in order to fulfill some other agenda other than the reasons that we study that countries were at war? Theory, well, I mean, this seems quite a huge claim.
Okay, so when it comes to the war in Europe in 1914, of course, there were the... I'm speaking with regards to the U.S. entry into the war and to Britain facilitating that. I'm not talking about Germany, France, Austria-Hungary, or Russia, why they got into the war. They have their own reasons, some of which are related. But looking at the United States and how it shifted in its position towards interventionism, towards Great Britain, towards the establishment of this financial rule that, you know, was criticized quite heavily in the mid-noughts, this is where it starts. And this is where I think at that time a lot of the leftist commentary was lacking. It didn't go back far enough. The narrative that they seemed to be spinning was that after 1945, something went horribly wrong. And it's like, well, something went horribly wrong well before 1945 as far as American policy. Because they were still riding off of World War II was the good war. And nobody talks about World War I. And it's like, well, yeah, but if we keep going back, all of these things that you're complaining about existed more or less in the complete form in 1917.
Hmm. I mean, I don't know how much you want to get into some of the specifics here, but you know, from my point of view, Woodrow Wilson has always been a perplexing character because he kind of painted himself as this kind of moral, almost like a president as a theory cell, you know, like a kind of moral principled man and all this sort of stuff. There's another version of Woodrow Wilson that claims that he was a white nationalist and, you know, was friends with the KKK and so on. But also he's the man who, you know, oversaw America's entry into World War One. Can you shed any light on the actual figure of Woodrow Wilson? How up for any of this was he? Did he push back? I mean, was he captured? Like, what happened with Wilson?
Well, Wilson was a strong Anglophile. His sympathies were strongly towards England already. So it's not so much that he needed a whole lot of extra prompting in order to do this. But one of his personal aides, Colonel House, in 1916, as early as 1916, was having private conversations with Lord Grey, saying that America will get involved eventually. Just give us some time. We've got to finagle the democracy over here in the United States to get people involved. And one of the things you'll see in a lot of history of World War One is the secret alliances. England's alliance with France that wasn't put to Parliament, which then drug England into the European conflict. I suspect something quite like that was going on in the United States, where you had prominent influential politicians and businessmen who were like, no, we're going to back Britain up no matter what. We're just going to, it's going to take some time to massage the machinery of politics to get there.
Yeah. And it's, I mean, as you mentioned, it's a flip of where relations had been. You know, if you rewind 100 years or so, America, I mean, when was that? What was the War of 1812? That was the last time Britain and America had a quote unquote war, right? So, I mean, it ended in a stalemate slash British victory, or you know, it ended in a kind of, you know, they agreed to stop, but basically, and nobody really got anything. Obviously, Britain spent most of the 19th century at war with France, or the early part of the 19th century, at war with, you know, the Napoleonic Wars, funding various proxies. You know, there was kind of periods where there was a pivot towards trying to have friendly relations with Germany, and you know, and all of a sudden in the 20th century, all of those relations switch around, and now it's Britain and France and America united. This is the new alliance. So that's kind of an interesting turnabout in the space of 40 years.
Yeah, well, you see, the main driver for that was that the unification of Germany altered the balance of power in Europe. So no longer was France considered the main continental threat. But nonetheless, yeah, England redefining its relations with both the United States and Russia was a Herculean effort. I mean, they had all been historic rivals to Great Britain.
Mm-hmm. Do you think any part of it, because, I mean, this is something I've talked about with other people, Semiagog, I remember doing a stream on this with. Do you think that people within the British hierarchy at the time could kind of, I mean, I know the British Empire didn't actually reach its peak in terms of actual territory control until, I think, the mid-1930s, right? But some of them could probably see the writing was on the wall, that they were already past the point of what you might call high noon for the British Empire. And, you know, all of these things that you're talking about is kind of an insurance policy, is kind of a, well, you know, the new world is going to be a bit different moving forward. How much of that was going on?
Well, the idea that England couldn't take on both European and North American threats was acknowledged by the leadership class. And they were like, well, look, allying with America gives us a free hand to take more direct stances against Germany in Europe. And also, you know, the fact that they are still English-speaking peoples, common, you know, relations over centuries. But again, this is more of an elite thing. Even right up until 1941, the American people were still heavily isolationist. And it must also be remembered that after World War I, there was a massive reaction against the intervention in Europe. You had the Nye Committee, with Senator Nye investigating how armaments sales drew America into the European war. You had Smedley Butler's War is a Racket, where he talks about how war profiteering. He makes the claim that the United States entered the war in 1917-18 because the Allies were losing. And if they lost, they wouldn't be able to pay back the loans that they had borrowed for weapons. And so it was quite unpopular in the interwar period. And also they failed to secure American entry into the League of Nations. So that bid didn't really work. They laid the foundation, they learned some things, but ultimately the bid wasn't successful.
So you suggested that when we talk about corporations now, there's some kind of direct link back to all of this. How does it all link up, Todd? Because one way of looking at it could be to say, well, okay, that group of players there in the late 19th century, early 20th century are quite different from the set of players in the World War II and are quite different from the set of players now that America has experienced its own kind of mini circulation of elites in that time. How would you respond to any of this?
Yeah, so the first thing is, one, some of those family interests are still around. Carnegie, Ford, Rockefeller, Morgan, they're still around. Second of all, this is more of a playbook, right? So if we envision that there's this space that's been created for these, you know, corporate titans, so they, you know, they rise to power in the 1880s and 90s economically, and then they consolidate that with the Federal Reserve Bank and control of elements of the U.S. government and education. The idea then becomes, how does this class then maintain control of the country domestically and generate profits abroad? All of these mechanisms are developed and still used today, but they were developed in the early 20th century. And so, one, this shows us a playbook that class uses. Sure, there's new people in there's the nouveau riche. There's new people in now, but they're all still playing the same rule. They're playing the same game according to the same rules. And these historical events show us the rules and the game that they're playing. That's the main thing. But then also, it's the detailing how they also accumulated control. So, importantly, in 1917, Senator Calloway said that in 1915, Morgan's sought to dominate U.S. media by finding the most influential news outlets and buying them up. They knew they couldn't buy them all up, but they bought the most influential to then have a trickle-down effect, and they decided on 25. And a lot of this sounds like what you would have heard in the, you know, knots with the corporation type stuff. And so the idea is then, this isn't new, right? This sounds a lot like, you know, Mockingbird, where the CIA is getting involved in the news in order to have a positive spin on it. So all of these playbooks, all these runs have been developed since 1913.
I mean, one of the strategies that I've looked at in the past is, I gave a talk years ago. You can actually find it in this book, Applied Elite Theory. I gave a talk called The Octopus, where I said, well, look, but like even beyond corporations, you have what we call now NGOs. Okay, you've already mentioned foundations, Todd, but it strikes me that this has been a mechanism that they've used quite a bit. I've got a book here that somebody recommended me years ago by René Wormser called Foundations, which actually looks at all of these foundations, the Rockefeller Foundation, the Ford Foundation, and so on. These days, we're used to thinking of the way that Bill Gates or Larry Ellison put money, lots of money, into these foundations. Those foundations then make, quote, charitable contributions, and they end up, that money actually ends up in something like the Tony Blair Institute today, or various other NGOs that have existed before. And in fact, I've got several books looking at the exact process by which that is. I mean, one of the best ones is still the transgender industrial complex, which looks at how all of those foundations funneled money to various LGBT groups in the 60s and 70s and so on, in order to manufacture consent and agitation and activism around that issue. Is that basically the playbook they're using before World War II?
Well, they're developing it, yes. This is the key thing that the Rees Committee was investigating. They were like, okay, how do these foundations, which do exist, advance these corporate interests subtly, and to the extent that they change the American political system? And yeah, that's certainly part of it. And so, for example, there, even before World War One, but then up through World War One in the 20s, I think it was Carnegie that did a lot of endowing for libraries. And so what you're doing is you're creating this sort of educational control grid, where you're the one that controls education. You're the one that, if I give you money as a grant, you then have to do what I tell you to do, right? So it's not just me, funding education. It's me also telling you how to teach people. And then, so this creates, and what's the goal? Well, the General Education Board of 1913 says, the broad goal for their education initiatives is that people just do what they're told, right? They just want people to do what they're told. So you can do that from a corporate perspective, loyal, obedient workers, but also the war perspective, people to go fight the wars that the corporations want. And so they're much more sophisticated now, right? But these trends, these observations really go back to World War One, where they tried to do it, and they got America in the war, but then they didn't get the League of Nations and they didn't get other things, and they just kept refining those methods. And mm-hmm. The really important thing here is with regards to also education is history. In 1946, the Rockefellers had an annual report where they said that they were basically going to fund education initiatives to tell the official story of World War II, to avoid the blowback that happened after World War I, which with what they call journalistic debunking. And one of the leading American historians at the time, Charles Austin Beard, said that this is the corporate takeover of history. And so this is something you won't really see from the left, because World War II for them is the good war. But it was the end of World War II in order to prevent the sort of anti-interventionist, isolationist mindset from returning, as it had after World War I, that the Rockefellers started to get more involved in history and funding. And even before that, you had the American Historical Association, which was in part created to create this new history consensus. See, that's how these groups work. These nonprofits, these foundations, they create consensus so that politicians take advice from them, or that other schools who want to be considered, advanced and cutting edge education will then take their cues from these groups. And all of that comes downstream from the funding that they get from, say, like Rockefeller or Carnegie.
And the modern form of that would be something like fact checking, would it, Todd? Or are we talking something even more?
Well, no. It's not quite fact checking. It's less than accreditation, but it's more than nothing. So it's sort of like if you want to have here's a good example. In World War II, there were no China experts, so the United States State Department went to the Institute for Pacific Review, which was a Rockefeller, a group, and they had a lot of very pro-Maoist, anti-Chang recommendations. And since this was the only, quote, experts on East Asia that the State Department had, the Roosevelt administration made decisions based on the IPR, which was already serving a certain Rockefeller interest, giving them not the full picture.
Interesting. One of the things that I have been interested in, obviously, as a fan of James Burnham and what he talks about in the managerial revolution, is the severing of ownership and control. And one of the things I remember looking at, in fact, it's in Populist Illusion as an example, is how control of the Ford Foundation was wrested away from the actual figure of Henry Ford or the actual Ford family. I mean, they still exist, right? The Ford family is still around, but they exist almost as managerial functionaries. And in terms of like decisions, allocation of funds, interests, etc., arguably that machine is kind of working for itself, or, you know, was taken away at some point. After Henry Ford died, he had a son, he died. His grandson, I think his name was Henry Ford III, basically a bit of a dipshit, and he ended up signing over and losing control of key decisions. And lo and behold, the Ford Foundation became one of the principal funders of what we would call the POS, Todd, you know, social liberal right-on causes, probably which would have horrified real-life Henry Ford, who was a conservative. I mean, have you given any consideration to the way in which these things take on a life of their own, independent of the wealthy families that started them?
Well, I guess I want to ask, who did end up buying out the Ford Foundation?
Well, it's not buying out.
Okay.
It is functional control. That is, who is the CEO? Who are the people on the ground making those decisions? So do you see what I'm talking about there? So
yeah.
So that you can still have ownership. The Ford family can still own the foundation. But it is what is being done with the billions, if not trillions, of dollars of assets in there. And it's the actual managers on the ground end up making decisions that perhaps the Ford family wouldn't have made. Does that make sense?
Yeah. And so the idea, I think where the sort of analysis is getting a little confused here is that at the beginning, when you have these prominent men with their corporations and their titan shadow, then they pass. What they're doing is they're creating a new space for action. And so it's like this is where all the real business and all the real stuff is happening. Everything else that we're consuming is kind of, you know, kayfabe. And so as more and more, as that space grows and more people enter, it becomes more chaotic. I'm not claiming there's a unified vision here. There's a certain, you know, New World Order sort of like old right kind of critique where it's all controlled by a single cabal and everything's in lockstep. It's not like that. It's more like that we have the real game that nobody's looking at, that we're not supposed to look at. And it's evolving and growing in different ways. But I'm pointing to that because that's where all the actual decisions are being made. And so
these are the actual castles to capture, or where actual politics is being done, actual power is being wielded, and everything else we see is downstream from it.
Yes. And so to tie into that, over the many years, we've all struggled to define what is the culture war, what is all this? And so for me, the big problem was, if you look at what people say they want, I mean, this is what you talk about, AA, right? Declared preferences versus real preferences. Well, what explains this difference? Well, part of it is, I think, that people are dupes, you know, what Lenin calls useful idiots. So the idea is, if you look at the culture war, what I define it as is a frozen conflict led by counter gangs. A frozen conflict is a geopolitical term where there's no peace treaty. There's also no active violence. right? So North-South Korea, it's an armistice, it's not a peace treaty. It could theoretically flare up later, but it hasn't. So that's the frozen conflict part. Counter gangs are where you have, you know, let's say you have one revolutionary group and then the occupying power funds another one to then fight that one and then disperse that energy, right? Mm-hmm. That's what a lot of these, I think, personality drivers are that we see in the culture. And I think the ultimate reason why this was created in the 60s, this is the height of the anti-war movement. This is the height of, you know, the anti-corporate movement with, you know, labor unions and the pro-labor movement. And so all of this is converging and they don't want that. They don't want that. One of the singers from the period, Phil Oakes, who committed suicide in 1976, said that you don't need you want a monoculture if you're going to fight back against the war machine and big business. You don't want all these subcultures because it diffuses the energy of it. He's one of the few people that saw what would happen to the anti-war and pro-labor movement with this. And a lot of this is pushed by these foundations, these groups that are not actually a part of the government or directly a part of these corporations either.
So rather than talking about being against war per se or foreign policy matters, you're now talking about flower power or how many transgender bathrooms or some other bullshit in a nutshell.
Well, yeah. So like, for example, France and Germany opposed the US invasion of Afghanistan, but by Obama, they recast it. They're like, no, we're here to like liberate women from the oppressive Islamic Taliban. And all of a sudden France and Germany are like, great, we'll send troops over to Afghanistan. And so he was able, that rhetoric, right, is then able to then pivot some of these European countries who were initially opposed to the U.S. interventions in the Middle East to be supportive of it. Because this was a part of the game plan all along.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, you do get these comical moments where culture war issues then threaten to invade serious foreign policy. I'll give an example. In the past week, Elon Musk has been fined by the European Union for something or other. I mean, they see him as an enemy, so they're fining him. Whatever the pretext is irrelevant, really. I think they're saying that the blue checks on Twitter are problematic for some reason, that they're like fraudulent or they give people an authority that they don't have or something. I don't really understand what but they're fining him like $120 million. And I saw all sorts of irate people on Twitter saying, look, Trump needs to get serious. He needs to threaten to pull America 100% out of NATO unless the EU reverse this decision and things like that. And you kind of have to laugh because the notion that America as a country would pull out of NATO over that culture war, something what is effectively a culture war issue, to me is farcical. Do you know what I mean? But every once in a while you see this, and actually the Trump admin lean into it sometimes with the kayfabe. I mean, some of J.D. Vance's speeches and things, when he's talking, you know, he brings some of that stuff. But I'm convinced that stuff is not intended as a serious message to European leaders, but for domestic consumption. It's slop, basically, to get people fist pumping because it's easy to bash Europe from an American point of view, you know.
Yeah.
And it gets right-wingers going in Britain and Europe and so on. And they can also slop post about it. But at the end of the day, we know this stuff is fluff. It's not going to actually affect, you know, the permanent interests of NATO and, you know, the projects that they're doing, you know?
Yeah, yeah. And so a lot of this, so tying this all together, the idea of these foundations, the idea of the culture wars or frozen conflict led by counter gangs, these people don't want to be seen for what they are and for what they're doing. They want to hide, right? So this is, you can sort of use this as a smokescreen, but the problem is it's sort of like deploying poison gas from a canister. If the wind blows the other way, it blows into your face. So you need the smokescreen in order to hide your power so that people don't start asking uncomfortable questions, don't start putting pressure on their governments to put pressure on you. But by the same token, right, you do run the risk of like what would have happened in the Cold War, where like an asset just goes rogue and you have to take care of it, because that he wasn't supposed to do that, right? So this wasn't supposed to happen. And so I think you kind of get lost in your own sauce, so to speak, early on in this propaganda war, beginning, say, in World War One. There's still a single culture, right? And so it's easy to sort of stay on point with a handful of points that don't sound obviously silly from a national perspective. But then when you have this culture war with all these competing diverse interests, yeah, it starts to get really weird. And you see this with the Biden administration with, you know, all of his LGBTQ props and everything. It's like, you know, a good example, another good example would be in the U.S. Embassy in Kabul, where they put George Floyd. I mean, how tone deaf, right? This is Afghanistan, right? And they put up this mural of George Floyd. It's another one of those moments you're talking about.
No, absolutely. I mean, I have a buddy here in this country called Lewis Bracknell, I think his name is. Sorry if I got his surname wrong, but you know what I'm talking about. He's got a beard, and one of the things he likes to do is send freedom of information requests to the government, because by law, any member of the public is meant to, you know, the government is meant to be transparent. This is democracy at the end of the day, Todd, you know? So every once in a while, they'll send them a letter and he'll be like, look, I've got a freedom of information request. How many times has Keir Starmer met Larry Fink? How many times has he met Larry Ellison? And what were they discussing? And then he gets these, I mean, they have to respond by law to the freedom of information request. So eventually they get back to him and they say, well, look, we've studied, like, is this in the public interest? No. We're not going to tell you, basically. So he keeps on going these letters back. You know, he's keeping a paper trail of it, of the government basically saying, like, yeah, we were discussing important stuff, but it's not for you to know.
Yep.
That happens more and more. So it's like, well, okay, but everybody knows that the conversation between Keir Starmer and Larry Fink, or the conversation between Keir Starmer and Larry Ellison, is more important than whatever they were debating at Prime Minister's Questions.
Yes, yes. And the smokescreen, if you will, the veil of illusion is lifting, and especially in the United States with recent Trump saber-rattling with Venezuela. They're not even really hiding anymore that they're going to benefit financially from Venezuelan oil, right? So the real people in charge, right, don't even feel the need anymore to hide. And I think that's an indication of at least two things. They think that they're secure in their position. And it's also, I think, a sign of hubris, because their position security was founded on the fact that they remained hidden and that they manipulated people from behind the scenes. The minute you stop doing that, you then draw all the heat to yourself. That was what they wanted to avoid the whole time.
I mean, in the Venezuelan case, it's even more brazen. It's like they say, oh, this is ultimately about the war on drugs. So, you know, they're sending over like cartels and things. And then he goes and gives a pardon to a massive drug baron. You couldn't make it up. You actually couldn't make it up. It's just farcical. Okay. So because it's become more naked and in your face, do you see any signs of this corporate oligarchy breaking apart in the future?
Well, I think the most likely first point of danger of breakage would be just another runaway war. You know, I don't think the United States... So if we look at the U.S. power projection in 2001, we look at U.S. power projection today. Today, we can't envision the U.S. doing a full-scale invasion of, say, Iran, like the U.S. did a full-scale invasion of Iraq in 2003. Another series of, you know, no-win war.
Can I just stop? Why is that? Why is that? Because I keep on being told America's got the biggest army ever. It's got, like, all the best equipment and so on. Why can't they launch the full scale? Like, why is it just like lack of will? Like, what's the reason?
Well, I mean, I think the reason why they can't do it anymore is because of the blowback of the war on terror. It would be hard to mobilize a large enough group of men to fight. I think in 2003 it was 150,000 U.S. forces, which still wasn't enough to secure the country. They would have, you know, they would have had to have far more. But the main reason is recruitment levels. All across the U.S. Armed Forces, there's recruitment level issues. also issues of just broader health amongst the military age men that they could recruit. I mean, if you want to go full human wave attack, World War One, I mean, I suppose you could, but that would be political suicide, I think, in the US.
I could sell the war on Iran to the MAGA chads.
Well, to them maybe. But then also I think you're like,
I could be like, look, do you realize that Iran is the transgender capital of the world? That, you know.
Wow.
Okay, I mean, yeah, it's true that they frown on homosexuality there, but there is a get-out clause where you can, by order of the Ayatollah, get a sex change. So, you know, if you really want to show those woke mullahs something and give them what for, you know, you could try to frame it as a culture, as an actual culture war issue, and go to war on those terms.
But yeah, the attrition.
Todd, I'm not even joking though, because
I know.
So much of the Ukraine Russia stuff has been like woke transsexual Ukraine against trad and based Russia. You know, that's literally how it's been framed in the American conversation. And Russia's leaned into it in their own propaganda. So it's like, well, you know, you just use that same. Anyway, go on.
No, yeah. No, but my point is, if we have another round of no-win guerrilla wars, say in Venezuela this time, I think that would be a serious blow to the U.S. power projection. I mean, in the sense that the war on terror was a serious blow to U.S. power projection. Partly, I think, because one, domestically at home, people are a little more suspicious than they were in 2003 because we now have all of this in hindsight. The poor health of military age men in the country, recruitment is way down across all, except I think the Marines, all U.S. armed forces. And so getting all of that together would take, unless you have a direct attack by a country you could pin it on, then maybe that would do it like it did in World War II with Japan. But I think that the economic costs of war and the economic costs of maintaining a war are where the U.S. enemies are going to try to bog down the oligarchy. Now, as far as domestic pushback, I don't really see a whole lot yet. But the thing is, they're only just now taking off the mask, right? They're only really just now coming out openly ruling in their own name rather than using some sort of a pretext.
Very interesting. Yes. So in a way, America, like, they need like Maduro to stand down or something.
Yeah, because I mean, the other thing you could think of, there, given what we have officially reported, there aren't enough U.S. Marines and military ground forces for a full-scale invasion, which if any sort of like direct attack is planned, I'm wondering if it's going to be more like the Bay of Pigs. In which case, if that goes south, like the Bay of Pigs went south, that could really be a bloody nose.
So I'd have thought just like Venezuela. I mean, okay, Iran is one thing, but Iran is a historical fortress, very difficult to attack. But I'd have thought Venezuela would be a doddle for America if they really wanted to do it. No?
Well, I mean, with not with the current forces they have deployed. I mean, yes, if the United States did gear up for a full-scale invasion like they did for Iraq, and you have 100,000 plus soldiers. Yeah, sure. But I don't think 10,000-15,000 is enough.
Right. Very interesting stuff, Todd. Very interesting indeed. One thing we didn't get into, I guess, is that one of the different things between now and 2003 is that there are a lot more named billionaires, I guess you'd say, like, who are live and active in politics. The most visible, of course, is Elon Musk, but there's also Peter Thiel, Marc Andreessen, you know, the base tech bros, as they've become known. What is this? How do you see those figures vis-a-vis this structure that you've been talking about? Are they ultimately part of it? Are they something new? This is something people have debated. I know King Pilled famously was like, well, they represent a new power faction in American politics. Where do you see the base tech bro billionaires fitting into all of this?
Well, I would say that given what we've been talking about. They exist in this space. They're playing that higher order game because they're players in that game, and they are new players. And so, yeah, I would agree with both of those points. I think that they tend to be more pro. So the sort of like wealthy interests that are more left coded are opposed to Russia. They're pro Europe, anti Russia. This group is the more quote unquote right coded is anti China.
Yeah,
though not Musk. Musk actually was opposed to Trump's tariffs on China. But generally speaking, though, they tend to be
probably
more
thinking about the price of chips and stuff, isn't he?
Yeah, probably. And then also because of the Cuban angle, the anti socialist regimes in Cuba, Venezuela, and Guatemala. But they also want to make I think that's where we're seeing a lot of these initiatives for like more American nationalist style content. And also more health oriented content, so you can't wage a war with a bunch of anemic woke people. It's just not going to happen. And I think they realize this, and they're like, well, look, if we want to keep this game going of the American Empire, we can't really do it with this woke albatross. Biden thought he could try, that's not going to ultimately be a long term sustainable thing.
And do you think that's why, I'm just thinking outside the box here, do you think that's why ultimately Russia have targeted so much of their propaganda efforts at the Chuds, at the nationalists? Because, I mean, whichever way you look at it, Russian messaging is absolutely virulent in American and European right-wing spaces. You know, to the extent that you're going to get non-NATO lines on things, other than certain far left groups and, you know, the Jeremy Corbyns and so on, you're going to find it on the right. You're going to find it on, Judge Napolitano's channel or people watching Duran and things like this. But also, you know, I mean, let's think, just name some names, right? Bronze Age Pervert, who's clearly, you know, part of some right wing network, frequently had the Russians with Attitude on his podcast, okay, who were Russian nationalists who would give then the Russian point of view on the war. Now, not all nationalists were pro-Russia, but lots and lots of them were and have been. And I wonder whether Russia target them because they know ultimately they're the people who are going to be targeted for recruitment. So it's like, well, it's hearts and minds, but it's hearts and minds of potential recruits. Or is Russia not that sophisticated? I think it probably is.
Well, you know, that's an interesting take. I'd never considered that before, but I wouldn't be surprised. Because, again, especially with regards to Europe, right, if you can increase nationalist tensions, you can undermine NATO and the EU, which would, of course, strengthen Russia vis-a-vis its immediate neighbors in the East. And as far as psychological warfare operations, I wouldn't – you know, the Russians have been very sophisticated ever since Lenin. So I wouldn't put it out. I'm going to put it that way.
Yeah, I mean, just on a slightly different tack, one figure who keeps on reoccurring in current politics again and again, we already mentioned him in passing, is Larry Ellison. Okay, I mean, Larry Ellison is the number one backer, Todd, of the IDF in Israel, okay? He is the number one backer of Tony Blair, who... Well, you can look at my back catalogue on Tony Blair and the power that he wields personally, okay, and the size of the Tony Blair Institute, right, largely propped up by Larry Ellison. Larry Ellison is also one of the richest men in the world and, you know, the founder of Oracle, but also he is the beneficiary of the buyout of TikTok. He has recently bought CBS and installed Barry Weiss literally in one of the most naked and open, yeah, I'm just going to buy this and we're going to get rid. I mean, Barry Weiss came out and said the purpose of my job here is to keep voices like Tucker Carlson and Nick Fuentes out and highlight real voices like Alan Dershowitz. I don't know who wants to watch him, but you know what I mean, right? But it's naked, yeah, and in your face. So I have a question about him as well, about Ellison, because, I mean, whenever I've seen him talk, he seems genuinely like a James Bond mastermind villain with plans to survey us all. Everybody's seen the Anna Kasparian clips. I mean, is he just like a lunatic outlier, or is he simply the number one beneficiary of this structure that we've been talking about this whole, like, has he managed to capture it, basically?
Well, yeah. So I think these personalities, right, they all that come out of this space, they are going to be, of course, uniquely coded to who they are, as well as their broader. See, here's what I think. I think what we're seeing now is this split. A lot of this stuff was probably happening behind closed doors. I mean, let's shift our focus to like the old aristocrats of Europe, right? They all did. You had, you know, Roman emperors, right? You had crazy people and kooks, but a lot of times you want to keep that behind closed doors. You know, they do it and then it happens. But so there's an impression that develops that these people weren't like that in the past. It's just that they didn't talk about it. They didn't do it publicly. There's a lack of discretion these days. And I think part of it is it's because they think they're so confident in their position. They think they're so confident in their position, they can just come out and act as if they, you know, would do it in private, and they just don't care anymore because, you know, they have in their mind, right, all of these resources. And so I feel like they're like, they, well, also too, I talk a lot about collapse on my channel. So it takes a lot of money and energy to keep the smoke screen going. It is possible that they made the assumption that, well, look, we're on a downward slope here. We're just going to rule in our own name right now and, you know, play hardball and stop with the footsie and the smoke screen, because and that's just too expensive. We don't want to do that anymore. It's just too expensive to do that in terms of energy and money and so on. So we're just going to go out in the open now. That could be the case as well.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that does strike me, though, I mean, just take the figure of Larry Ellison, right? I mentioned his, you know, meetings with Keir Starmer. He's constantly there in the White House. He was there at the inauguration. You know, he's just kind of openly buddying up with Trump at the moment, and Trump is, again, puzzlingly obsequious and subservient to some of these characters. If you go back and look at, like, actual John D. Rockefeller, you know, in Standard Oil, the history of Standard Oil and Rockefeller was that he was constantly at odds with the federal government, constantly being sued, antitrust lawsuits, trust busts. You know, there was a lot more friction and kind of hard power politics back in those days. Whereas now, it just seems that they're just in bed, that the government and these oligarchs are just openly in bed in a way that I think was, at least, I mean, you could say, well, it was kayfabe back then, but I'm sure Rockefeller wouldn't have thought that after he'd been to, you know, hauled up by the Supreme Court for the 50th time or whatever, and seen his companies broken apart for the, you know, 10th time, or, you know, he would have probably thought, well, okay, you know, he had a, what I'm saying is his personal empire in some ways was subject to oversight by the government. Whereas now it seems like the government just does whatever it can to help these figures or to work with them, and has given up any pretense that it could fight back or not. You know, all the language is about public and private partnerships, and, you know, how can this corporation or that corporation or this billionaire or that billionaire help the public infrastructure through, you know, joint works, which in practice means the government handing massive contracts to Oracle, Palantir, Microsoft, whoever it might be.
Well, yeah, and certainly, you know, in the early stages of this oligarchy forming, there was going to be pushback, because the other element to the prehistory of all this is that after 1837, with the works of Andrew Jackson, we didn't have a national bank. The bankers were out in the cold after that, and so from 1837 to 1913, this higher order financial organizing process mechanism didn't exist. And so they had to recreate it. That's what the Second Bank of the United States was supposed to do before it was dismantled by Jackson. And so the idea then is they want to then, that was their first setback. So they claw back power, they get that bank again in 1913. But then, of course, you have the New Deal regulations, which could be seen as a setback. But ultimately, though, they got the two wars they wanted, and they eventually got the UN and all of this other globalist infrastructure – So you could view it as kind of a Leninist thing. Take one step back, take two steps forward, right? You take a setback with the New Deal, but then you get the globalist infrastructure with Bretton Woods. So it's sort of like in the long run, they'll then reclaw that power back and then turn the federal government into something subservient.
Fascinating. Also disturbing, because I just don't... You mentioned Andrew Jackson. I'm old enough to remember, Todd, when Trump put the picture of Andrew Jackson up in the Oval Office, up in his own office, do you remember, in the White House? Well, I mean, one of the first things he did is he put a picture of Andrew Jackson on his desk on the wall. And that got a lot of people excited, you know, especially the Ron Paul libertarians, you know, who then supported Trump. I mean, Trump is not going to do Andrew Jackson style taking on the Fed, is he?
No.
It's not going to happen.
No.
Yeah. Oh, well. all right. Well, I mean, there's lots more to discuss, but we've got an hour here, Todd. Where can people find you if they want to find out more about this? And what are some resources on this material you've been sharing?
Oh, yes. You can follow me on the Praise of Folly podcast on YouTube. Just type in Praise of Folly podcast and it'll show up. You can follow me on X at POF podcast. Some great works to look at. Well, probably the most important one, even though it's a bit dated, it's early 20th century, is the 1906 work by Frederick C. Howe called Confessions of a Monopolist. And what makes this so important is he comes from that class we're talking about, and he just says, okay, this is how we actually do things. Okay, guys, I'm going to tell you right here in this book how we actually do things, and it's not what you think it is. And that was that's probably the most important to read as far as figuring out how these people organize and control our political system. The other problem is there isn't really a book. Oh, well, there's The Creature of Jekyll Island. That's another one you should read. But then also, a lot of this stuff isn't found in a single book. It's not really something you're going to get a research grant for to then write about. I mean, maybe now you might, but not for the longest time. And so this is the result of years of work with me searching around the interwebs, you know, Internet One, finding all this stuff.
Really interesting. I'll just remind people, pick up a course at the Academic Agency, and I'm sure Todd will join us again soon. Bye, everyone.
Bye.
If you like this video, be sure to like and subscribe. You can join the channel for thousands of hours of past shows in the archive and hundreds of videos. If you have any questions, you can leave a super chat or a super thanks, and I'll be sure to pick it up during my weekly office hours, which run every Tuesday afternoon. I also provide courses at the Academic Agency, which I encourage people to buy. Thousands of students now have taken the Trivium to improve their skills in writing, logic, and rhetoric. Just three of many courses available. Buy it now. But most importantly of all, friends, get out.